WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Reverend Johnny Ray Youngblood about breaking from the fundamentalist church tradition he grew up in and creating a ministry of social activism that makes the teachings of the Bible more relevant to the everyday issues of his community. And we talk to Youngblood about how he revived a dying church in one of Brooklyn's poorest and most dangerous neighborhoods and turned it into a pillar of the community. Also today, TV critic David Bianculli reviews the new Bill Moyers documentary series on public television, Healing and the Mind. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Laura Kanoy. President Clinton today unveiled a new technology initiative he said will create scores of jobs. The president's announcement came during a visit to Silicon Valley in California, where many high-tech businesses are located. The program would shift billions of research dollars from defense to civilian use. It includes tax credits to encourage more high-tech developments. Later in Seattle, President Clinton told Boeing aircraft workers he'll keep a close eye on European subsidies of Boeing's rival Airbus. Mr. Clinton said Trade Representative Mickey Cantor will make sure European nations stay within the limits on subsidies under a 1992 agreement. At the United Nations, the Security Council has unanimously adopted a resolution that calls for the creation of a war crimes tribunal in the former Yugoslavia. The resolution gives Secretary General Boutros Boutros-Ghali 60 days to report back to the Council with concrete proposals on the legal structure of such a court. Trevor Rowe reports.
The War Crimes Tribunal comes as a response to mounting reports of widespread raping, massacres, and ethnic cleansing in the former Yugoslavia. It will be the first time since the Nuremberg trials of Nazi officers at the end of World War II that such a court has been created. British Deputy Ambassador Thomas Richardson told the Council that the court should ultimately allow for the prosecution of those guilty of war crimes.
All parties share responsibility for these breaches. We believe that the Serbs have been most culpable.
What's unclear is how the prosecutions can be carried out effectively. Already, diplomats say it will be extremely difficult to gather evidence. This is Trevor Rowe in New York.
Near Aspen, Colorado, a mountain rescue team has so far turned up no sign of five missing cross-country skiers. Mark Roberts reports.
The search team struggled with high winds, snow, and whiteout conditions today, trying to reach the area where the group of cross-country skiers is lost. The mountain rescue team reports no sightings of the missing skiers. Pitkin County Deputy Sheriff Joe DeSalvo says the mountain rescue team today reached three backcountry ski huts built to shelter cross-country skiers.
The ground rescue team is in the area of a skier's hut. A search of all three of the huts has shown negative. There's nobody in any of them.
DeSalvo says if searchers find nothing by nightfall, they'll spend the night and get a fresh start in the morning. For National Public Radio, I'm Mark Roberts in Denver.
Warren Christopher was in Beirut today. He's the first Secretary of State to visit the Lebanese capital in almost 10 years. Christopher's trying to revive the Middle East peace talks. He said the Lebanese want an early return to the talks, as do the other Arab leaders he met with over the weekend. But Arab nations say Israel must allow 400 expelled Palestinians to return home before negotiations can resume. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials closed higher today, gaining 21 points. This is NPR. In Los Angeles, a 12-member jury was chosen today to try four police officers in the beating of Rodney King. The jury consists of 9 whites, 2 blacks, and 1 Hispanic. A congressional report criticizes Canada's system of government-established drug prices. The study by the General Accounting Office comes as lawmakers and the White House are looking at capping prescription costs. A Canadian review board sets and enforces drug prices, but the GAO report argues while the system has controlled prices, it may have hurt Canadian pharmaceutical research and development. U.S. troops were unable to pull out of the Somali city of Kismayu today as planned because of renewed factional fighting. NPR's Suni Khalid reports.
Forces loyal to Somali warlord Mohamed Saeed Hirsi today clashed with troops loyal to Colonel Omar Jess in the southern port city of Kismayu, according to a U.S. military spokesman. Colonel Fred Peck, the U.S. military spokesman in Somalia, called the factional fighting a setback for efforts to bring peace to the war-torn nation. U.S. and Belgian troops in the area were not involved in the fighting, which left 7 Somalis dead and at least 21 others injured. Hirsi, also known as Morgan, is the son-in-law of former Somali President Siad Barre. His forces have been trying to recapture Kismayu since they were forced out by troops loyal to Jess last year. Meanwhile, a 23-year-old Irish nurse was shot and killed during an ambush of a relief convoy near Mogadishu. I'm Suni Khalid in Washington.
A federal grand jury has indicted Nicholas Rizzo on charges he defrauded the presidential campaign of former Massachusetts Senator Paul Tsongas. Rizzo was the campaign's chief fundraiser. The indictment says he put campaign funds into his own bank account and into another secret account. Prosecutors charge Rizzo used the money to repay personal loans. Rizzo pleaded not guilty. I'm Laura Kanoy, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The church has been central to the development of African-American politics and culture. But when Johnny Ray Youngblood first preached at St. Paul Community Baptist Church in Brooklyn, New York, there were only 84 worshipers. In the past 18 years, he's built up the church, and the church has helped rebuild the community. There are now close to 5,000 people on the church rolls. The church has a school and a bookstore, a jobs program, and scholarship fund. In coalition with other East Brooklyn churches, it launched a project that has built 2,300 affordable homes for low-income families. Reverend Youngblood started preaching when he was 12 at a church in New Orleans where he grew up. There's a new book about his life and his Brooklyn church called Upon This Rock. I asked Reverend Youngblood to describe the neighborhood his church is located in.
It is a community that at one time was predominantly Jewish and Italian. And some years ago, there was a flip, as it is sometimes called, where African-Americans and Latinos were allowed to come in because of panic selling and buying. And it is also the result of an overflow from a closer community called Brownsville, where schools were decentralized. And we are said to have the precinct that has the largest murder statistic. We are pretty much so, I think, defunct of city services, not as it once was because of what we're doing with housing and all there now, but it's looked upon as a poor working class community.
I'd like to compare the church that you grew up in to the church that you've created. Let's start with the church that you grew up in. Can you give us a brief description of what that church was like?
The church was extremely small. I was there even a year ago, and it seats less than 100 people. At that time, the pastor was a woman mentioned in the book by the name of Fannie B. Jordan, who was uneducated and who did not have a great love for academic training, and was also pretty much so caught up in what is sometimes called folk religion. It was an eclectic group that had some stuff from the Methodists and some from the Roman Catholics and some from the Pentecostals. So it was a gumbo kind of situation where women were the dominant population and the key leaders in that congregation. And the vision over and beyond fundraising and personal piety and morality had no vision at all for social change.
Now, the leader of the New Orleans church that you grew up in, Fannie B. Jordan, who you just referred to, she thought that you were called to preach. How did she let you know that?
By force. I grew up extremely intimidated by this lady. And, of course, learning theology through her initially, it was like she and God were on such great speaking terms that whenever she spoke, it was just a divine echo. And the last thing I wanted to do was either live in hell here or go to hell at the end of existence here. So whatever she said was what I did. She, I guess, was the E.F. Hutton of that situation.
Is fear the only thing that kept you in church?
No, I enjoyed the fellowship. I enjoyed doing the music. I enjoyed learning, though that was extremely limited because I was not allowed to ask a lot of questions. And the reason I told the story in the book is because it is not idiosyncratic to my life only, but there are numerous people, both whites and blacks, and probably Latinos even, who kind of grow up in that kind of situation.
What was it like for you to preach in that church? What kinds of sermons would you give?
Oh, I would give the high morality sermons about no drinking and no smoking and no dancing and loving one another. And, of course, I counted on an amen more from Fanny Jordan than anybody to let me know that I was saying the right things.
Do you give those kinds of high morality sermons now?
Terry, you've read the book. I think you know I do not at this point.
And why not?
Well, because the problems are much larger than the individuals. Individuals do have to recognize that we have somehow or another inculcated the problems of the larger society, that the problems in the larger society are the manifestation of problems within ourselves, and we must work on both fronts. We have a phrase in the African-American community of making it live, and that means that we must make whatever we teach from the scriptures to be relevant to our day and time and the problems that are looked upon both by media and by ourselves as an individual ethnic group as the problems. And morality sermons are really what drove a lot of men, including myself, away from the church.
I want to get back to that a little bit later. My guest is Johnny Ray Youngblood, who's the pastor of St. Paul's Baptist Church in the Brownsville section of Brooklyn, New York. And there's a new book called Upon This Rock that's about Reverend Youngblood and his church, and the book was written by Samuel Friedman. Now, you went to divinity school as a young man. Were the teachings about God in the Bible very different from what you were used to?
They were extremely different. Divinity school stripped me of everything that I really had ever learned. Plus, I guess I might say, since this is your line of interest right now, that I was discouraged both by my mother and by Fanny Jordan from going to divinity school. I can remember on one occasion I was sitting in an Old Testament class, and one of the professors was talking about a passage from the second chapter of Genesis, and he started talking about how God went sashaying through the garden in the cool of the evening. Well, I looked for the lightning bolt right then, Terry, to strike and kill the whole class, you know, for him to refer to God as sashaying through the garden. So it tested me. It strengthened me overall, but I was stripped of everything that I arrived at divinity school with. Though I had a college degree, I was still a kindergartner in terms of theological thinking.
What were some of the other serious contradictions between the faith that you had been brought up in and the teachings you were exposed to in divinity school?
Well, some of the contradictions were to look at the Bible as a literary document written, yes, by inspired men, but not necessarily true from cover to cover. I had to deal with the whole aspect of culture that was involved in the writing of the scriptures, which was something, of course, I didn't know about growing up in school. And that has served to strengthen me. I remember particularly studying the book of Amos because it was one that Martin King spoke from. And in speaking, in learning about that, what was told us in seminary was that Amos himself owned the sycamore trees that he also tended. Well, that took something from what I had thought prior to that academic exposure, because I thought Amos was merely a worker there taking care of the trees. And it gave me a whole new perspective on what the gospel is about and to whom the gospel must be preached and what angles that light must shine.
When everything that you knew about your faith was challenged, did religion itself start to seem hopelessly subjective and open to interpretation? Did you temporarily lose your faith?
For a little while, yes. What kept me there was my love for my mother, and what kept me there was my love for my maternal grandfather, who were people committed to the church. And I then made up my mind that I was not going to leave, but that I was going to dig to find and mine the gold that kept them there. And I lost my faith, so to speak, in terms of what I actually believed in. But somehow or another, I hung on to the possibility of prayer being a working spiritual discipline. And what I did was I engaged in a prayer method of my own that was not that reverent, but very direct, carried definite tenets of anger and frustration and challenge to God, and not just that kind of what I call namby-pamby. But it is the loss of faith that now helps me to pastor people who have also lost their faith.
Because you understand it.
Because I understand it.
What were some of the difficulties that you faced the first time that you preached at new congregations?
Well, I felt at points hypocritical, Terry, because I knew that I was involved in a struggle of faith, and I really did not want to perpetuate the shallow, cheap kind of faith that I felt I had grown up under and that I had been taught. So I didn't want to be a perpetuator of that kind of shallow thinking, of that kind of what I call namby-pamby commitment. And I felt hypocritical because I was in a struggle, and I was told by people that we should not struggle with our faith. We should just accept. And then after that, what happened is I began to realize that I did not believe the way people close to me believed. And there was the serious fear of the intellect that had been taught me by Fannie Jordan. So to bring mind to ministry, to bring intellect to emotion, was something that you just didn't do. And I was bringing that by raising questions. I was bringing that by dealing with everyday nitty-gritty, gut-level issues that people wrestled with, not in terms of not going to heaven or not going to hell, but about living in hell in these ghetto communities.
Can you give us an example of the type of thing that you said in one of those early sermons that ended up being very controversial within the church?
Well, a couple of things. One is there's a passage in Romans chapter 8 that is always quoted about, I will let nothing separate me from the love of God. Traditionally, that had been interpreted that my faith is so strong and my commitment is so great that I will not allow anything to get between me and God and stop me from loving God. That's the way it had been interpreted. When I looked at it and really dealt with the passage, I also knew that when I juxtaposed that with some of my experiences with people, that people had left the church because their parents died. They had left the church because they got better jobs. They had left the church because somebody enraged them. They had left the church because they had committed some immoral act seemingly for which there was no forgiveness. So the passage couldn't mean that if it was good news. And I discovered that what it really meant was that there is nothing that can happen to me or nothing that I can do that will stop God from loving me. Because overall, we had been taught that if we committed immoral acts, unethical acts, or when things happened, we were not to question God. And now we know that God is not going to stop loving us.
I want to talk about the process of turning around the church, but first we're going to take a short break. If you're just joining us, my guest is Johnny Ray Youngblood, pastor of St. Paul's Baptist Church in Brooklyn, New York, and he and his church are the subject of a new book called Upon This Rock, and the author of the book is Samuel Friedman. This is Fresh Air. Reverend Johnny Ray Youngblood is my guest. Let's get back to 1974, the year you took over St. Paul's. What was the state of the church when you became the pastor?
Well, the congregation had gone through a serious church fight, as it is called. My predecessor had been coerced to leave, and the people there were at odds with each other. And the offering, which is one way to gauge things in terms of financial support, was about $125 on a good Sunday. The average attendance was anywhere from maybe 30 to 60. And the physical structure then, there was one way in and one way out upstairs where you had to, we had to build a little ledge like to dangle coffins off of when we had funerals. And just really, really chaotic. They were on the bottom, I can say that. And of course, what has happened is inevitable because when you recognize you're on the bottom, there is nowhere to go but up.
What role did you want the church to play in the community?
I felt that the church should definitely be, as one of my professors taught me, the critical conscience of culture, and should somehow or another be able to organize leaders with definite skills and abilities, and that these skills and abilities should be used to enhance life in that community and ultimately life in the city and the nation. And when I arrived at St. Paul's, the people with the basic skills to do some of that, a whole young adult population had been lost because of a fight between my predecessor's predecessor and the congregation. And we now have at St. Paul's Community a judge, a family court judge who is also an usher who has returned since I've been there. The principal of our elementary school has returned to the church since I've been there. And others are steadily coming back because they now recognize the relevance of our work and our commitment.
One of the things that's been very important to you at St. Paul's is bringing men back into the church because so many of the men in the community had stopped coming. Why has it been such an important part of your mission?
Well, primarily because men have just been absent. African-American males have not been there. And then the brethren who were there were brothers who, in a sense, had kind of done everything they could do, dissipated all of their energies and resources. And as I said in the vernacular, they had kind of drug up the leftovers to God. And I needed robust men who were yet energetic, imaginative, insightful, who wanted to do some very positive things and not be considered an endangered species and then just sit around waiting on death or to be victimized by those who had given up on life. And I was able to find a number of what I really call blessed men. There is a fellow there by the name of Rochester Blanks who was born out of wedlock. When I met him, he was in his late 40s, and he had a problem with the church and has since given up his job and come to work at St. Paul's Community. His entire family is there now, and he works in the community. He is respected by all of the children who lovingly call him Uncle Rocky. There was a brother by the name of Leroy Howard who used to drop his wife and children off at church and then go down the block and hang out on the parking lot and just drink beer for about 2.5 hours and then go back to pick up his wife. He has since come to work at the church and given up his job. And is respected by people all over, as well as in East Brooklyn churches and throughout the city.
When you took stock of the reasons why men had stopped coming to church and then tried to figure out how to change the church to make it more inviting for them to return, what did you come up with?
I came up with the fact that they had to know that I was a man of their own coast, which is a biblical phrase meaning that I was a man dealing with my own maleness. I was an African-American male dealing in this society that is has race as a very central issue, and I was affected by everything that that they were affected by, regardless of my status as reverend and pastor. I discovered that there were things going on in the church that was very much so geared to the ladies and the children in the church because, of course, they were the dependable group that would show up. I in turn recognized in dealing with my own maleness that I had to deal with some of the central issues of my life. One was that I had no relationship with my father, who was at home but who was emotionally distant, and I could not wait for him, so I had to become the aggressive one, and I went in and have built a relationship with my father where now at 44, I can say that my father is my hero. Of course, I'm the one that's 44. Also, I had a son before my marriage, and I had not acknowledged him. In fact, had attempted to run from him and dealing with that awareness. And I had to reconcile myself to that and then be open about it. And as I began to do that, the men began to trust not only me as minister, but they began to love me as a man. And then they began to deal with the things that had kept them from church. They began to deal with things that had them so down on themselves. And also, they began to deal with these weapons that other people had used against them to count them as unworthy of church, unworthy of a decent thought, unworthy of being men.
You said that you had fathered somebody before you were married, and that it took you a long time to admit to that publicly.
About 20 years.
Yeah. Do you think a lot of men who were in a similar circumstance, who became fathers out of marriage, felt that they couldn't possibly go back to church because that kind of person, that kind of life would be completely unacceptable?
I have no doubt about that. And again, as I began to set the example, there were men who started a relationship with sons and daughters that they had neglected, and some who even owned up to and shared with their wives that they had other children.
There's probably a lot of teenage girls who become mothers outside of marriage in the church. How do you deal with that?
Well, there is the story in the book. It was the first story, really, that I wept over after Samuel Friedman put the book together, of Natasha Johnson, who is now 15 years of age. She was the first child born during my tenure out of wedlock. And there's a story in the book about how I was approached by the officers about what were we going to do about those girls. There was another friend of hers who was also expecting at the time. So I just decided that I would attempt to reason with them and take my chances. And I said that, number one, they were not pregnant for the church. So why would they have to come up and confess before us? And then I became facetious and shared with them, because the actual wording was, what are we going to do about these girls who are around here sticking out pretty badly? And I just resented that kind of language. So I said to them, well, I'll tell you what, let's get us a Bard Parker and we can solve the problem there. Well, they didn't know what a Bard Parker was, and that happens to be the knife that physicians use to perform Caesarean sections. And they then understood that I was angry about it. So I said to them that I will visit the parents in the hospital, I will urge them to bring the children to the church to be blessed, and I will do everything possible to help these mothers provide a better life for the children than they had. That was my commitment. And since that time, Natasha, who is mentioned, has attended our elementary school all the way through. She calls herself my daughter and is a very wonderful and promising young lady. And she's an example of what love can do over against judgment.
Johnny Ray Youngblood is the pastor of St. Paul Community Baptist Church in Brooklyn, New York. He's the subject of a new book called Upon This Rock, The Miracles of a Black Church. The book was written by Samuel Friedman. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Reverend Youngblood will be back with us on the second part of our show.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Reverend Johnny Ray Youngblood took a dying church in Brooklyn and transformed it and the community around it through innovative programs. Some of these programs were designed to bring African-American men back into the church. But some of the Reverend's methods have been controversial, like creating an all-male board of elders. Coming up, part two of our interview with Reverend Johnny Ray Youngblood. Also, TV critic David Bianculli reviews the new PBS series on alternative medicine, Healing and the Mind. It's the latest series by Bill Moyers. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. U.S. Secretary of State Warren Christopher has arrived in Israel on the last stop of his current Middle Eastern trip. He's trying to get the stalled Middle Eastern peace talks back on track. NPR's Linda Gradstein reports.
Secretary Christopher arrived in Israel 6 hours later than planned because of a surprise trip to Lebanon. Christopher comes to Israel with the agreement of all of the Arab states involved in the peace talks to return to the table.
Working together, the United States, Israel, and the Arab and Palestinian negotiating parties can turn this process into one of real breakthroughs and achievements rather than missed opportunity.
Christopher's main goal in his 2 days of talks here will be to get the Palestinians to agree to attend the next round of peace talks. The main obstacle continues to be almost 400 Palestinians expelled by Israel in December as suspected Islamic fundamentalist activists. Palestinians say they must be returned immediately. Israel says they can return within a year. Christopher reportedly is coming with some new ideas to bridge the gap and make sure the peace talks get started again. I'm Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem.
President Clinton and Vice President Al Gore were in California's Silicon Valley today, where they unveiled the administration's new technology proposal, which they said would push the country forward competitively and create scores of new jobs. NPR's John McChesney has a report.
The new technology initiative includes most of the ideas President Clinton advanced during his campaign. At the center of the initiative is a dramatic shift of federal money away from defense-oriented research and development to civilian commercial purposes. A permanent research and development tax credit for companies exploring technological advances is also designed to increase civilian R&D. More money would be made available to the Commerce Department's Advanced Technologies Program, which grants money to companies pursuing research in high technology areas. The program proposes a partnership between the auto industry and the government to create an environmentally clean car. Finally, a major priority of the package is more money for a national information infrastructure, a program heavily promoted in the past by Vice President Al Gore, who will spearhead the entire administration technology effort. In San Francisco, I'm John McChesney reporting.
In Germany, firefighters in Frankfurt today used high-pressure hoses to wash down streets contaminated by tons of chemicals. A leak from an overpressurized tank sent some 10 tons of chemicals into the air, and residents were told to keep their children indoors and not to eat food from their gardens. Officials said the chemicals could cause skin irritations and breathing problems. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up nearly 21 points to close at 3,342.99 in heavy trading. This is NPR News. In Los Angeles, a federal jury has been chosen in the trial of four L.A. police officers on charges of beating Rodney King. The jury includes 8 men and 4 women, 9 of whom are white. In an earlier state trial that acquitted the officers on most charges, all jurors were white. 3 alternate jurors are yet to be chosen. Under a court order, the jurors' identities will not be made public, and the jury is to be sequestered during the trial. The Supreme Court has left intact a state court ruling that allowed a fertility clinic to destroy 7 frozen embryos that were being fought over by a divorced couple. The mother wanted them preserved, but the father wanted them destroyed. NPR's Nina Totenberg reports.
The embryos in the dispute were frozen at the fertilization clinic at a time when the Tennessee couple in the case were married and wanting children. but they made no written agreement about what to do in case they divorced, and when they separated, the wife wanted to preserve the embryos so that she or another woman might carry them to term, while the husband did not want to father any children. The Tennessee Supreme Court ruled that in the absence of a written agreement, ordinarily the party wishing to avoid procreation should prevail. Pro-life forces aided the mother in an appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court, arguing that an embryo is a person, while pro-choice forces aided the father, arguing that an embryo is not. Today, the U.S. Supreme Court let stand the Tennessee court decision favoring the father. I'm Nina Totenberg in Washington.
Also in Washington, the U.S. Supreme Court has agreed to hear a case involving how much money public schools are forced to pay when private schooling is needed for children with special educational needs. At issue is a South Carolina case where a school district was told to pay nearly $36,000 to parents of students with a learning disability who spent 3 years in a private school. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. We're back with Reverend Johnny Ray Youngblood, pastor of St. Paul Community Baptist Church, located in a poor and crime-ridden neighborhood in Brooklyn, New York. In the first part of our show, Reverend Youngblood told us that one of his missions is to bring African-American men back into the church. So one of the programs he created was an all-male ministry in which men could openly discuss male issues with each other. Although St. Paul is still attended primarily by women, Reverend Youngblood has made the board of elders all male. I asked him if he was bringing back men at the expense of women's ability to have power or authority within the church.
Well, I think I can say to you, you'd have to kind of talk to some of the sisters at the church to have them better explain it, but it is not male ministry at the expense of women. In the main, the average African-American woman in church has already prayed that their husbands, fathers, sons, brothers, etc., would return to the church. I had to explain to the ladies that if these brothers were going to come back, they were going to need something to do. And then, of course, in their coming back and my giving them something to do, I had to find a central point to meet. This is both women and men and children as well. So what we did was we recommitted ourselves to being what we call a Bible-based church. That is not ultra-fundamentalism, and I talked about that earlier in terms of this morality thing.
Mm-hmm.
But we decided that the church would become our kind of constitution and bylaws. And what happened, Terry, is that the scriptures, of course, portray men in the leadership. Well, men have been in the forefront of leadership in the African-American church, but primarily in the pastorate. It's been the women who have really kept the church going and who have carried out the programs and kept the church alive while men were absent. So in bringing the men in, a number of the women were glad to see men come in and take what they call their rightful places. Now, at the same time, know that my administrator is a woman at the church. Know also that the principal of the school is a woman and all of our faculty is female. The women's ministry has three people in charge of it, of course, women. And wherever a position is open and I can find a lady to fill it, the women are not disallowed positions in the church based on gender. The Board of Elders, and I've said this on several occasions, for a season is all male. We believe in time that that's going to be opened up, but I need an arena in which to train men without women. And see, the way I look at it is in the African-American community, the problems in the African-American community are in some ways similar to that in white communities, but never exact. And this whole business of feminism, we understand it and we respect it. But in the African-American community, you have to understand that the emasculation of African-American males has been continuous. So we have to do something different to solve our problems because men have not done to African-American African-American men have not done to African-American women what the feminist movement tends to talk about a great deal, because we've not been in those positions. Now, that, in a big way, has been our goal, because white males have set the model for what manhood is, but we are now learning that that may not necessarily be the model that we should emulate.
Just one other question about this. If the Board of Elders is, for now, all male, is it in a way teaching men that in order to come back to the church, that you're creating an atmosphere where men can dominate, they don't have to share power with women on the Board of Elders, they don't have to let women be their equals on the Board of Elders, they could just have that to themselves, you know, that are you saying to men, we welcome you back and we'll let you rule to show you how much we want you?
No, that I guess if you look at the curriculum of what we teach, even though that could be misconstrued as what's going on, the men know and they are taught that we want to work this thing together. We have to work it as African Americans. We must do it together. We've already been divided and conquered for so long that there is no way we can now engage in our own methodology of divide and conquer. Our Board of Trustees is very mixed, and that is, of course, the governmental mandate from the state of New York. And we mix in every way that we can. But the training of men, it is necessary that men have some time to themselves without female presence. And know also that we will bring women into our male meetings to talk to us, because we do engage in dialogue to hear what the women need and what they want, what they're afraid of, and we do the same with them.
Can you give us a sense of some of the things that come up at the male ministry that are different than the subjects that would come up at a regular church meeting, and some of the things that the men might feel free to say in the all-men's meetings that they perhaps would not say at a regular church meeting?
Well, the whole issue of their fathers. Men do not want to talk about the gaping holes in their souls that are the result of non-relationships with fathers. Men are willing to struggle, even tearfully, about not having a relationship with their sons when they recognize the perpetuity of what they have been through. They discover that, wow, I'm doing the same thing to my sons or my daughters that was done to me. And they're willing to wrestle with that. And to even, we bring in therapists from time to time who talk to us straight out about what we have to do. Also, men are willing to talk about having been abused as children, in a setting where other men start to talk about that, but they really don't want to do that when it comes down to being around women. I have men who were involved when the Gulf War was initiated. We were meeting, and the brothers who had been involved in Vietnam began to share their stories that they never told their wives or their children, about how there was one brother in particular, I remember, who was victimized by drugs, who stood up and began to talk about how his job in Vietnam was to collect bodies, put them in body bags, and then stack them in airplanes to have them transported back here to the States. The brothers don't want to talk about that around their women because they feel that it's just so horrible that it would give women good reasons not to love them.
You were telling us about how it took 20 years for you to publicly admit that you had a son before you were married. And I think you were probably afraid that you'd lose the congregation if you admitted that publicly. Was it treated as a scandal when you told your congregation about that?
No, not at all. And that's the joy of why I was willing to put it in the book. In fact, I flew my son in to New York and had him to come before the congregation and to introduce him to them and them to him. And they accepted it. They understand forgiveness. They understand love. They understand mercy in ways that they have not understood that before.
There are many African Americans who've turned to Islam. Do you see Islam as being competition to you? Are you trying to attract people to Christianity, or are you equally happy if someone has found a sustaining faith, no matter what that faith is?
Well, let me first of all say that when I was a product of the traditional church, I saw Islam definitely as competition.
Mm-hmm.
The way I have described myself is that I am the Muslim that never left, in the sense that in bringing my intellect and in bringing my anger to the Christian faith, it has been dealt with in a way that I now no longer see the Nation of Islam as competition. What I recognize is that they were dealing with some aspects of being African-American males and African-American women in this, racist society of ours in a way that Christians have not dealt with it and have decided to shut their eyes to racism. So what I do is I just bring those aspects of our existence into the Christian church, and we're able to deal with them and deal with them in a really loving and promising kind of way. I also know that very probably the Christian church will not win everybody, and the Nation of Islam needs to be credited with the good things that it has done, particularly in the lives of African-American males.
So if there is somebody who is thinking of leaving the church to become a Muslim, will you try to talk them out of it, or will you just encourage them to follow their faith?
No, I will try to talk them out of it because, number one, that is a bit of an indictment against the church. So I want to know where I'm wrong as well as where I'm right. I want to know where I'm on target, and I want to know when I'm missing the target. So I will talk to them. If I discover that they have their minds made up and they just want to go that route, then they get my blessing on it.
My guest is Reverend Johnny Ray Youngblood, pastor of St. Paul Community Baptist Church in Brooklyn, New York. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Reverend Johnny Ray Youngblood, pastor of St. Paul's Baptist Church in Brooklyn, New York. And there's a new book about him and his church called Upon This Rock. The neighborhood that your church is in is a very poor neighborhood. The church needs money to operate, and, the plate is always passed around in a church. Is it difficult to ask money of people in a congregation that doesn't have a lot of money?
Well, it used to be, Terry, but also our neighborhoods are characterized by numbers joints, and you have to put up money to play the numbers. Drugs are not for free. Liquor is not being given away anywhere. And what's called in our community Mother's Day, which is, the time for welfare checks, it is very evident that there is money within the African-American community. So it is not difficult in terms of recognizing that our people have money. It's a matter of channeling that money toward constructive self-help efforts. And we do that, again, by way of the scriptures, by teaching tithes and offerings, and then engaging in programs that will be beneficial to the people, and they in turn are willing to support those efforts.
Give us a sense of the kinds of programs that you've built over the years. You've got a housing project that's built affordable housing for low-income residents.
Yes, well, by way of our coalition with churches of other denominations, Roman Catholics, Lutherans, Episcopalians, and Pentecostals, we have been able to put together a primary health care center. We have been able to deal with street signs in our community, as well as hold accountable supermarket agents and managers who give us the worst foods. And we've been able to work with the now lame duck chancellor to put together two public high schools in Brooklyn. We've also been able to engage in what we call Nehemiah 2, which is a work education strategy wherein young people who graduated from the two worst school districts with an 80 average and a 95% attendance were guaranteed jobs, entry-level jobs with banks, New York City housing, and scholarships in private institutions that connected with us also. That's what we've done as East Brooklyn Churches, organized by the Industrial Areas Foundation. Also, what we've done in terms of St. Paul's community is we've engaged in economic development by purchasing 11 stores. One at one time was a numbers joint. The other was a social club known for some prostitution, drugs, and numbers. We have worked with our young people to bring in kind of the Greek fraternity style of stepping and pledging and rites of passage. We have a chemically dependent people called the Wounded Healers. We have our intentional ministry to African-American males. And then we are all working together to come together that we might be child-centered, adult-run, and elder-ruled. And we operate on an African proverb that it takes a whole village to raise a child.
What are some of the accomplishments and tragedies that you've recently marked at your church?
Well, accomplishments, of course, is the ministry to men and the way we are able, along with the other congregations in East Brooklyn congregations, to negotiate power with people who are public servants and who are in positions to make changes in our communities, in our city, and ultimately in our state and nation. So that's really, really a wonderful kind of achievement. I guess the most tragic thing, and some triumph has come out of that, has been that last year around March, I had to do the funeral at St. Paul's Church of a young 15-year-old by the name of Ian Moore, who was shot to death along with another student at Jefferson High School, a school there in our community. Each day brings both its tragedies and its triumphs. So that's a part of life in the African-American community.
We only have a couple of seconds left for this, but when you're going through a crisis, who do you turn to? Many people in your church turn to you. Where do you go?
Well, I am open about the fact that I engage in psychotherapy. I have a therapist to whom I go, and I have some congregants who are willing to hear what I've got to say.
Reverend Youngblood, I thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry, for your interest.
My guest has been Reverend Johnny Ray Youngblood, and he's the pastor of St. Paul's Baptist Church in Brooklyn, New York. And there's a new book about him and his church called Upon This Rock. And the book was written by Samuel Friedman, former reporter for the New York Times and also author of the book Small Victories.
What is this I can feel deep down inside? What is this that keeps setting my soul on fire? Whatever it is, it won't let me hold my peace. What is this? I can feel, oh, deep down inside. What is this? It keeps setting my soul on fire. Whatever it is, oh, it won't let me hold my peace. Makes me, yeah, love my enemies. Woo! And it makes me, yeah, love all my friends.
This is Fresh Air.
This is Robert Siegel. Of all things considered, on today's program, we'll be hearing about President Clinton's trip to Silicon Valley, where he talked about his administration's policy toward encouraging high-wage jobs in high-tech industries. We'll We'll also be hearing about the United Nations decision to impanel a tribunal to investigate war crimes in the former Yugoslavia. And Michel Trudeau reports on what schizophrenia has done to one family and how one member's illness has affected the lives of all the others. Also, a talk with artist Art Spiegelman about the death of Harvey Kurtzman, one of the founders of Mad Magazine, and anagrams for the new administration coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio.
Tonight through Wednesday night, PBS is presenting the latest documentary series by one of its most prolific contributors. The series is titled Healing and the Mind with Bill Moyers, and it's about alternative medicines and medical treatments. TV critic David Bianculli has a review.
In the first hour of Healing and the Mind, Bill Moyers takes us to China and into an operating room where Eastern and Western medicines are meeting. A female patient is having brain surgery, and the surgery itself is being done with what we consider traditional methods. But instead of being put to sleep, she's being given acupuncture. So she's awake during the surgery, a fact that really amazes Moyers.
I just looked into her brain and saw the tumor, and she's talking to you.
They've opened her skull, she has no pain, and they've used less than half the drugs we'd use in the West.
This is Bill Moyers taking his credibility and going out on a limb, a Shirley MacLaine kind of limb. In the first hour of Healing in the Mind, he checks out herbs made of dried geckos. He watches a martial arts master who appears to be able to stop and throw opponents using only his mind. And he visits doctors who treat tumors with massage. The remaining hours of Healing in the Mind take place in the United States, but explore other avenues of alternative medical treatment. Everything from placebos to meditation is covered here, in enough depth to really do them justice. The third episode, for example, is devoted in part to a stress therapy clinic for patients with chronic pain. We see their progress over a space of 2 months, and at the final session, with Moyers in attendance, we hear how even the most skeptical patients have felt a difference after their exercises with meditation.
Two people this week asked my wife, hey, what's with Danny?
Your friends are starting to ask your wife?
Yeah, well, they didn't say it to me. Well, no, it wasn't my friend, it was my mother-in-law.
Oh.
Boy, he's awful nice and talkative all of a sudden now. And I started laughing. I thought it was pretty good. I didn't notice that. I says, well, there's nothing with me.
The first hour of Healing in the Mind made me think, the second made me wonder, the third made me cry, and the rest had me spellbound. There was no reason for anybody, even Moyers, to expect he could duplicate the excellence or impact of his televised talks with Joseph Campbell. But he has. And each episode of Healing in the Mind relies on one or more medical experts to take him, and us, through these physiological and spiritual explorations. Put it this way. It's no surprise that Moyers is taking a 6-month sabbatical now that Healing in the Mind is being shown on PBS. It just means that when he was talking to all these people about what was really important in life and how to find his true center and stuff, he was also listening.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Post and author of Teleliteracy, Taking Television Seriously. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Joan Tuohy, with Sue Weinstein. Research assistance from Penny Nelson. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. Additional support comes from the George Gund Foundation. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Los Angeles is preparing for the federal civil rights trial of 4 white police officers accused in the beating of Rodney King. On the next Fresh Air, we'll talk to LA's new police chief, Willie Williams, about whether the police force or the mood of the city has changed since the riots that followed last year's trial. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.